The governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, told us during the week that we were in for 5 more years of recession. He didn't add plague and pestilence, but he might have. And just to add to the depression, it's 5 years since Tony Blair stepped down as British Prime Minister. No, I'm not depressed about that anniversary. I was and I'm overjoyed about it. It's that he wants to come back. And as Prime Minister, just when you thought it was safe to get in the water. Well, over my dead body, Tony. The Queen, in what seemed to be taken as an earth-shaking event, shook the hand of the former IRA commander, Martin McGuinness, in Belfast. She did wear gloves, though. And in what has become something of a norm, another bank was in trouble. This time, Barclays fined £290 million for trying to manipulate the price of crucial interest rates that affect the cost of borrowing for millions of customers around the world. Some week, the only thing missing was a euro crisis, but hey, I'll guarantee that's just days away. No prizes for predicting that, but I do predict that the next half hour will be lively, interesting and informative, because this is the real deal. Welcome to The Real Deal on Press TV, still the voice of the voiceless. I'm George Galloway, and every week in London, I'm bringing you the news and views you just won't get in the corporate media. Shooting from the hip and shooting from the lip, as always. And if you wanted to, you could fire back at me, at least by email, at the address showing on the screen. Now, the proprietor of the Independent newspaper and its sister paper, the London Evening Standard, is an interesting man. That's why he's a friend of mine. His name is Evgeny Lebedev, and I had lunch with him just a couple of weeks ago. He's brought innovation to the loss-making newspapers. The Standard is now given away free, and the two papers may even be on their way to breaking even. Lebedev takes a close personal interest in politics and interviews famous politicians around the world. So I suppose it must have been his idea to invite Tony Blair to guest edit The Standard on Wednesday. And in an interview to mark the 5th anniversary of his resignation as Prime Minister, Blair said he'd be willing to do it all again. Oh no, tragedy and then farce, as Groucho Marx would have put it. Blair claimed he'd learned much in the last 5 years, which would make him a better Prime Minister. What he's learned actually is to make a considerable amount of money from all the directorships and lectures and dodgy places that he's been involved in. Millions upon millions. He's rich enough to be a Conservative Cabinet Minister. Perhaps that's what he was suggesting. It was, of course, the bloody invasion of Iraq, which will be Blair's historical epitaph. He's never apologised, of course, and he will never face a war crimes trial. But things in Iraq are getting better, according to him. Iraq's economy is growing and infant mortality falling, or so he says. Some of us will never forget the hundreds of thousands of children who died under sanctions at his hands, and the countless more who perished thereafter, again at his hands, under shot and shell. I was viciously castigated a few years back, say, what else is new, for meeting a leading Irish Republican and former provisional IRA commander, Gerry Adams. I've also met Martin McGuinness, another ex-provo, who is now Deputy First Minister in the devolved Northern Ireland Parliament. During the week, Mr. McGuinness shook hands with the Queen. Notable for several reasons. He's a Republican, obviously, and wants the abolition of the monarchy, don't we all? He also may well have been involved in the decision which led to the blowing up of the Queen's cousin, Lord Louis Mountbatten, by the IRA in 1979. But most importantly, it's notable for the way that peace has been embraced in the north of Ireland. As Churchill put it, much better to jaw-jaw than to war-war. There's been lots of jaw-jaw about reforming the British Parliament, and that's going to continue. It's about the unelected House of Lords, which has no real function other than to make suggestions and to delay legislation and make elderly men, mostly, look silly in red ermine gowns. But I better not say more, because I might end up there. But the government's come up with a reform plan which isn't even half-cocked and stands no real chance of being implemented. Under the plan, 80% of the House would be elected, phased in over 12 years. But members would serve for 15 years, Now that's a job worth having. There would still be bishops, of course, as of right, amongst the 20% of unelected members. A neat merging of church and state, but above all, the legislation that's proposed is a bodge. That may, of course, be what the Tory leadership wants, to see it rejected and the idea thus tucked away for another few centuries, so the Tory toffs, maybe added to by me, can continue to dominate the red leather benches of the House of Lords. Barclays Bank was hit with £290 million in fines for its serious widespread role in trying to manipulate interest rates and the cost of borrowing. Now, you would think bank bosses would be hiding under the covers for several years after the way they've brought the Western world to the brink of total disaster. Once, twice, I've lost count, but not a bit of it. You might even have thought that the Barclays offence was a criminal one, but not a bit of that either. Financial authorities found that a significant number of employees, including senior managers, were involved in the scam, which called into question the integrity of the markets. Markets? Integrity? Well, they said that. Embarrassing emails were made public, including exchanges where Barclays staff were offered the finest, by which they mean the most expensive, bottles of champagne for their favours. So it's plus a change in the City of London. This is probably just the first of a series of massive similar fines on international banks, and they tried to convince us they'd reformed and were properly regulated, even over-regulated. From the serious to the absurd, but still talking about bankers, of course, the boss of NatWest and the Royal Bank of Scotland has been forced to apologise to thousands of customers and promised to pay them compensation for the bank's computers crashing for days, leaving thousands of people without access to their money. You couldn't make it up, and the bankers certainly can't to the public. After 30 years of conflict and 3,600 lives lost, it was greeted as a milestone in Anglo-Irish relations, and the Queen shaking Martin McGuinness's hand may well have been. But if it was a milestone, the final destination for the former IRA commander is still a united Ireland, a 32-county Republican Ireland. But the handshake was hugely significant. It was the first historic encounter between the preeminent symbol of British rule in the six counties of the North with McGuinness, a die-hard Republican leader, if no longer one of the IRA's senior commanders, and now elected Northern Ireland's Deputy First Minister. Long unimaginable, it drew another line under what we knew as the Troubles, the 30 years of armed conflict carried out by the IRA against the occupying British state. But while there was the historic handshake, the Queen's husband, Prince Philip, whose uncle Lord Mountbatten was assassinated by the IRA, moved quickly away as McGuinness moved towards him. My studio guest knows a lot about Northern Ireland. He's a former Shadow Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, a former Member of Parliament, a former bigwig in the Liberal Democrats. He's Limbit Opic. Colourful name, colourful guy, good friend of mine, and well worth hearing from. Limbit, welcome to the Real Deal. I know that we're going to talk about the very, very fine book which you've just produced and has just been published. But first of all, if I may, I'd like to ask you about two other things. First, the Martin McGuinness, Queen of England handshake. As a former Shadow Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, as they call it, how did you evaluate that?
First of all, a lot of people never thought that would happen at all. And in fairness to the Queen, I think that she must have thought long and hard about it, not least because of the sensitivities in her own family, as you just described.
With Mountbatten.
Yeah, the death of Lord Mountbatten. And that's going to be probably the one thing that seals this peace process for the good now. And she must have swallowed hard to do that. But also for Martin McGuinness. I mean, he was shaking hands with an individual he wants to abolish. So both of them walked a long way to make that happen. And I think that was a great moment in Northern Ireland history.
I'm with you on that. There hasn't been a backlash from the unionist side, but there has been something of a backlash from the recalcitrant Republican side. You think McGuinness will ride that out?
He will ride it out, and it was inevitable. The unionists have to stay quiet because they'll have regarded it privately as something of a victory, really. But they shouldn't, because it's most important, the fact that this reconciliation has really got to the very top. Whether one is a Republican or a monarchist, she still represents something very establishment about the United Kingdom. And so for her to have shaken hands with one of the most important players in the history of the IRA, I think think really does say we've really moved on. It's just the dissidents now who haven't let go of the violence completely.
OK, let's move on to another of your campaigns, which is I think, in your book, but might well have been, because it's a case in point, a case study almost. Yeah. Tell us about this Mr. Larkin, the American citizen, just flatly banned by the British Home Secretary from entering this country. Why?
That's right. I'm a libertarian. I genuinely believe in freedom. And a lot of this book, The Alternative View, is about freedom. And what's happened over the last few weeks is a case in point of hypocrisy, I think, from the British government. On the one side, we go to war because we want to enforce civil liberties in other countries. And at the same time, people like this American citizen, Tim Larkin, are excluded simply because the Home Secretary doesn't seem to like the cut of his jib. And the official reason is that he constitutes some kind of a danger to British safety, British security, law and order. But she is completely unable to give a single shred of evidence why that's the case. So we go to war abroad to try and make people tolerant, and then we exclude people, American citizens with no criminal record, on the basis of prejudice. That doesn't add up for me.
I'm with you on this case. In fact, I've been asking questions in Parliament about it. So we'll keep the viewers fully briefed on how that campaign goes. But it's your case in the book, which is a very, very fine book, The Alternative View, The Way Back for the Liberal Democrats. Let me ask you the first question. It is an alternative view. It's genuine libertarian material in here. But the Liberal Democrats are not going back to that, are they?
At the moment, this party is very far from my alternative view. In one sentence, what this book says is, unless the Liberal Democrats really get back to a liberal and democratic position, they're in very serious danger of complete meltdown at the next general election, which could be 2014, 2015. Why? Because the party seems to have lost its way. I was in favour of the coalition between the Conservative Party, which is the larger of the two parties in that coalition, and the Lib Dems, which is much smaller. But I wasn't in favour of it like this, because I believe that, just as we discussed with Tim Larkin, people should really walk the talk when it comes to tolerance, when it comes to consistency. And that's not what's happened with the Lib Dems.
Well, it can't be, can it? For a start, your party is in bed with what is and has been for centuries the authoritarian party in Britain. It's a mismatch from the out on that. And the constant struggle that David Cameron has is not, it seems, to keep the Liberal Democrats on board, because they've gotten into the ministerial limousines and don't seem to want to leave them. It's to palliate the far right of his party, many of them rabid backwoodsmen, red in tooth and claw, blue in tooth and claw. It just seems to me the Lib Dems are now just a fig leaf for this.
Well, actually, it's smarter than that. And I have to say, David Cameron has exceeded my expectations in his ability to be a political strategist.
He's a smart guy.
He's a very smart guy, because both of those things work to his favour. On the one side, I think that Nick Clegg, who's the Deputy Prime Minister and also the leader of the Lib Dems, has let himself be played to move far too close to the Conservative agenda. So the Lib Dems have lost their identity in a way that the Conservatives haven't. On the other side, as you say, there are these baying voices from the backbench of the Conservative Party who say to Cameron, you've gone too far, you've given too much to the Lib Dems. Now that works for Cameron, because it means he can turn to his coalition partners and say, I can't do any more than this. And also it looks like there's an element in the Tory party that is unreconstructed, that still appeals to the very reactionary electorate in the country. So he actually wins on both scores. I actually go into this in the book, and we talk about the fact that this whole attitude goes right back to the 1850s, 150 years ago. And then it was called muscular Christianity. The idea of the British man walking across the world, and I quote, with a Bible in one hand and a musket or a gun in the other.
What's changed?
Well, nothing, apart from the name. It's now called muscular Christianity.
Muscular liberalism.
Sorry, muscular liberalism,
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah. But with a small L, of course.
Yeah, it is. And yet, it was Cameron who said to Clegg, why don't we talk about muscular liberalism? And then Clegg adopted that like a Trojan horse offered to him by the Conservatives. And basically, it's destroying the credibility of the Liberal Democrats from the inside out?
Well, that certainly seems to be the case. Just in the last few days, David Cameron laid out what most commentators, I think, saw as a pretty vicious, certainly pretty comprehensive assault on the welfare state, on the so-called feckless poor, the undeserving poor. I mean, these were all 150-year-old phrases and concepts that he was dealing with. And he made it clear that the government, as soon as it gets a chance to, is going to go for these targets and abolish these benefits and these safety nets that have quite long now existed in this country. So Nick Clegg doesn't have any alibi of not knowing what the Tories are really like, what the Tories would really like to be doing. And yet he shows, to me at least, every sign of being much happier in their company than in yours, for example. And you're a long-time senior member of the party, long before he was.
Well, it's true that Nick Clegg was, if you like, a latecomer to the more traditional Liberal Party or Liberal Democrats. It's also true that he seems to have a more comfortable relationship with the Conservative Prime Minister than he does with the more traditional and, I would like to say, libertarian wing of the party represented by people like me. Now, why is this? Partly it's because of personality. Clegg was in the right place at the right time to become leader, and it fitted very comfortably for him to work with somebody who also had conservative views like Cameron. I think they have a lot in common, and certainly historically and in terms of their upbringing they do. But secondly, and even more importantly, it looks like the party was blinded by the light of power. They could be stronger. They could rein in the Conservatives, because the last thing the Tories want at the moment is a general election. They'd lose it. But Clegg does not use that leverage to say, we're not going for the deconstruction of parts of the welfare state. And yet the Conservatives clearly do want to do that in some areas. In the health service, we've already seen that. We've got the Chancellor who has actually failed to implement cuts and has achieved a recession at the same time. And the Lib Dems have been drawn along with that as well. What can they do? They could actually have more backbone. They could start flexing their muscles. At the moment, there's little sign of it.
So how's it going to work now when the general election comes? I won't press you on your own plans. But are the two parts of the coalition going to break a little bit before the election is called? Or are they going to be sitting together in the cabinet room, doing all sorts of, from my point of view, monstrous things, and then when the election's called, start fighting like ferrets in a sack? How credible will that be?
We looked at all the scenarios in the book, and our conclusions were quite surprising, certainly not what we expected. The most likely outcome will be that the Conservatives will choose a moment to push the Liberal Democrats so far that they have to walk away from the coalition. Then what Labour will say is, you can't vote for the Lib Dems because that's the same as voting Tory. And the Tories will say, the Conservatives will say, don't vote for the Lib Dems because they've just walked away from a promise to stick with the coalition to the end. So the Liberal Democrats will be caught in the crossfire from both the other two major parties. Secondly, some people suggest there could be a coalition in the election, but that can't work because the Liberal Democrats are already so beaten up by the damage that it's been done, that's been done to the party, that the rank and file won't go for it. So what does Clegg do? I don't think he can credibly lead the party into the next election, and if he does, we'll end up with a meltdown. And I would say that's as few as maybe 16 seats in Parliament compared to the 57 they've got now.
It would be even less but for the peculiar British electoral system, which the Tories managed to wreck your attempts to reform and didn't pay any price for it. Which gives the Liberal Democrats rather larger number of seats because of their regional strength than they might have when you looked at the national opinion polls as a whole. I've got to tell you, I think we may well be looking at the oblivion, the end, the demise of the Liberal Democrat Party.
The reality is that the Lib Dems really depend on the strength locally in local authorities, people who run the towns and the cities of our country. And the number of MPs the party has is roughly proportional to the number of councillors the party has. Well, in the last few years, the party's gone back from over 4,000 councillors to around just over 2,500. We've got the same number of councillors now as we had just over a quarter of a century ago, when the party had roughly 24 members of parliament. Now, it's all very well for Clegg to say, we'll be rewarded for doing the courageous things in this country, but we haven't got the troops on the ground to deliver the results. And there's no running away from those statistics. He can bury his head in the sand, as maybe him and some of his leadership team will do, but at the end of the day, the public will judge. You're also right. In a funny kind of way, the Lib Dems wanted to change the electoral system to a totally different one. But under that different one, the Lib Dems might have ended up doing even worse. Mm. So we may have been saved by the fact that the Tories pulled yet another successful, fast one.
So tell us what you're calling for in this book. You're calling for, of course, a return to genuine, what you call genuine liberalism, libertarianism. But what does it mean for the coalition? What do you say that Clegg should do now?
Three key messages. One is, get back to that liberal agenda. Some of it's uncomfortable, but it means don't ban people like Tim Larkin just on a basis of prejudice and misadvice. Do the right thing, tolerate differences of view. Secondly, we say, get that local government base up. That's not a very exciting message to people outside politics, but every Liberal Democrat knows that you've got to have people to deliver leaflets if you're going to win seats. And the third one, and this is the tough one, is for Nick Clegg to leave the leadership of the Liberal Democrats, carry on as the Deputy Prime Minister, but let the party be run by someone else. Then there's a chance that the coalition will last till 2015, and there's a chance that the party will recover. We're certainly going to lose seats at the next election. It's a question of degree. And I'm saying if Clegg stays in charge, he'll be personally liable for an even worse result and a step closer to the oblivion that you've discussed. Mm.
Now, who is in the wings? You're no longer in Parliament, though I think you would have made a very good leader.
Oh, thanks.
You're out of the running. Is there an alternative to Nick Clegg in the Liberal Democrat Party?
We think that there is an alternative to the Liberal Democrats. And rather than getting into names, because I'm sure if I put a name forward in that book, that name would be shot down in the same way that the leadership is very uncomfortable about my conclusions. But we do say the things that the next leader has to be. That next leader has to be distant from this coalition. They can't have played a central role supporting the Conservative government. That leader has to have been consistent in the promises that were made before the last election and not kept by a large number of Lib Dem MPs. And thirdly, that leader has to be able to appeal to the left-wing vote, which has all been lost at the moment. All that soft Labour vote that thought, well, we're not Liberal Democrats, but it's still better than the Conservatives. So left-leaning, distant from the coalition and consistent with the sort of liberal values that we put forward. There's a small number of people in that category, and one of them will be the next leader.
Now, just we've only less than a minute. We were talking before the show about the dereliction into which Britain is currently sunk. Yeah. You agree with the governor's view that we're in for five more years of this, at least?
I agree with the governor's view, and I agree with your view, which is, to be blunt, that the current plan A hasn't worked. We've got a chancellor who said it was going to have to be tough, but then we'd recover. It is tough, and we're actually not recovering. And that's a great tragedy, and he needs to either change course or change job.
Well, Lembit Opic. He's a serious heavyweight political figure. This is a serious heavyweight political book. It's called The Alternative View, The Way Back for the Liberal Democrats. And it's available in all good bookshops and on Amazon. I don't know where Lembit's political future lies, but I'm going to have a word with him after the show. He needs to find a dramatically growing radical party. And I've got respect membership forms in my coat pocket. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. God willing, there'll be more at the same time and the same place here next week. I've been George Galloway. This has been The Real Deal. And you have been a marvellous audience.